Welcome, everyone. Good morning, and welcome to What Clinicians Want to Know, addressing current questions and controversies in the management of myelofibrosis. I am Dr. Kirkendall, and I'll be moderating the meeting today. So this is our faculty for today. So we have our esteemed colleagues on the left here, Dr. Prithviraj Bose from MD Anderson, followed by Dr. Abe Yacoub from Kansas, Dr. Angela Fleischman from UC Irvine, and myself coming from Moffitt Cancer Center in Tampa, Florida. Here are the relevant conflicts of interest. And here's the commercial support for today. Research to practice CME planning committee staff and reviewers have no COIs to disclose. This program will contain discussion of non-approved uses of agents and regimens. Please refer to the official prescribing information for each product for approved indications. All right. And with that, I will say we're kind of starting up right now, but I will say in order to make this meeting more relevant to participants, a survey of 50 general medical oncologists was conducted over the last couple of weeks. So questions provided during that survey will be asked to the faculty. The full survey results are on the iPads and available in the Zoom chat room for your viewing. All right, so now we can make it to our agenda. So we have four modules today. The modules will be presented about 10 to 15 minutes, and afterwards we'll have some questions and cases to review. And so we'll start with module one. Where I'll discuss the current clinical decision-making for myelofibrosis in the absence of severe cytopenias. Then we'll follow that up with Dr. Bose, who will be talking about managing myelofibrosis for patients with thrombocytopenia, followed by Dr. Yacoub, managing myelofibrosis for patients with anemia, and then Dr. Fleischman will bring us home with future directions in the management of myelofibrosis. So before we get started, here are some of the data from the GMO survey. This shows their level of interest in topics related to the management of myelofibrosis. We'll be discussing these topics throughout the program. So if you look here as far as the topics of interest, certainly there's a large interest in discussing just the kind of frontline management of myelofibrosis patients who don't have severe cytopenia. So as you can see, the most interest will be in my program, guys. I'm sorry about that. And then that followed by certainly an interest in how to approach the patients with myelofibrosis and anemia. I think there's certainly excitement about what's coming down the pipeline, specifically with selinexor. Also excitement about talking about thrombocytopenia, as we know that can be quite challenging. And then I think that there's other promising agents that we'll hear a lot about at this meeting, including imetelstat, as well as other investigational agents such as zilurgisertib and navtemadlin. So with that, we will now move to the initial presentation talking about the current clinical decision-making for myelofibrosis in the absence of severe cytopenias. All right, so I think obviously to level set, and really I'm setting the stage for what's going to come after with these kind of more nuanced discussions about the challenging situations in myelofibrosis. But I think with any myelofibrosis talk, when we're talking about clinical decision-making, we have to start with ruxolitinib, because prior to the approval of ruxolitinib in 2011, this was a disease that was really manifest with prominent splenomegaly, constitutional symptoms. People felt very, very poor when they were showing up with this diagnosis, and we really didn't have too much to do for those patients. And really, ruxolitinib kind of changed that game, right? And it really allowed patients to feel a lot better and alleviate some of these more pressing symptoms. And then since then, we've been building on the successes of ruxolitinib with our further agents. So here you can see just a quick run of the COMFORT-II study, which showed the ability of ruxolitinib to achieve spleen volume reduction. Here you can see in that picture clinically what it's able to do for an individual patient, but then these figures also show the ability of ruxolitinib to achieve spleen volume responses, quote-unquote 35% reduction in spleen volume. Also, you can see in the waterfall plots that virtually everyone who gets treated with ruxolitinib has an improvement of some degree in their spleen size. These improvements happen quite quickly here. As quickly as 4 weeks, we're noticing changes in the spleen length by palpation, and they're relatively durable as well, at least over the first 3 to 4 years. We also know ruxolitinib is very helpful in symptomatic control and symptomatic improvement. If you look at individual symptoms here on the left, we're talking about symptoms that have to do with spleen volume, such as abdominal discomfort, pain under the left ribs, early satiety, but also constitutional symptoms, night sweats, itching, bone pain, muscle inactivity. These symptom improvements occur very quickly, even more quickly than perhaps the spleen volume reductions. When we talk to patients, sometimes patients are saying they can feel within hours or days that their symptoms have improved rapidly, especially when it comes to things like itching or pruritus. And this improvement in spleen volume and symptoms actually conveys a survival benefit. And you could see how that would happen even in the absence of getting kind of complete remissions or molecular remissions, then when patients feel a lot better, it actually is going to overall lead to a survival benefit. And I think one of the things that I continue to try to stress is that this idea of ruxolitinib being for higher risk patients, I think that's a misnomer, a misconception. Really, the idea of disease risk and those patients who benefit from JAK inhibition are mutually exclusive for the most part. Patients who benefit from JAK inhibitors are those that come in with splenomegaly and those who are able to be fully dosed, especially when it comes to ruxolitinib. And oftentimes, when we're talking about higher risk myelofibrosis patients using the DIPS or MIP70 or these various different prognostic models, those patients have a lot of cytopenias, which may actually make it more challenging for them to benefit from ruxolitinib. And so here, when you look at the intermediate one-risk patients on these different studies, you can see their response rates are actually quite higher than what we saw on the COMFORT studies. And this really is a manifestation of being able to fully dose these patients where otherwise you may not be able to. When you look at side effects of ruxolitinib, and I think it's when we're talking about management, this is one of the key things that comes in and will lead into our further discussions, that acutely the main side effects we see with ruxolitinib are really hematologic side effects, so anemia and thrombocytopenia. These traditionally occur within the first few cycles of treatment, and you can see on the left, you see this characteristic drop in hemoglobin that goes down by two grams or so and then kind of incompletely recovers. This is expected, and oftentimes that incomplete recovery may be related to dose modifications that occur. When you look at the right, you see that the general trend is that you don't continue at the high dose that you may start at. These are patients that start at 20 milligrams BID and 15 milligrams BID, and you can see that generally there's a dose reduction that occurs and then tends to plateau as you get further out. And while on the clinical trials, discontinuation due to anemia was very uncommon, we know that in the real world, this is a very common reason for discontinuation. This is work from ourselves as well as Dr. Palandri that shows in the real world, one of the most common reasons for discontinuation is due to cytopenias. And so we need to take that into consideration as we're managing patients with ruxolitinib. And one way to do that, it may be an alternative dosing strategy. Instead of starting at 20 milligrams twice a day or 15 milligrams twice a day, the REALIZE study looked at patients who came in with anemia and said, well, what if we start at 10 milligrams twice a day and then escalate the dose as tolerated by response and platelet count? And what we see here on the right is patients are generally started at this in the yellow bar, that's 10 milligrams BID. But after week 12, you start to increase that dose. And as you get further out, there's more orange and red in these bars, suggesting patients are able to increase to 15 milligrams BID as well as 20 milligrams BID. And overall, we saw that actual modified dosing strategy led to very good spleen and symptom responses. So it didn't tend to sacrifice our clinical responses for this modified dosing strategy. But the importance there is you have to continue to evaluate the ability to increase the dose. Now, when we're talking about kind of adverse effects or side effects, certainly in the acute setting, ruxolitinib is associated with cytopenias, and that's the main thing we think about. Otherwise, quite well tolerated. In fact, obviously, most patients are achieving rapid improvement in their symptoms. But when we think about kind of longer-term side effects as we're keeping patients on these drugs for longer and longer, you know, one of the things that we have to think about is weight gain, right? And so oftentimes, this is something that's less common maybe in our myelofibrosis patient, but also maybe because those patients are coming in with some degree of weight loss. So we hear a lot about this in polycythemia vera, where patients don't have that pre-existing weight loss. But this is something that really occurs regardless of the disease they're coming with or regardless of baseline weight. And so you can see here that these waterfall plots almost look like the spleen responses, where generally speaking, everyone is gaining some degree of weight, and in some cases, it can be quite marked. On the right, it doesn't matter if you start as underweight, normal weight, morbidly obese, there's weight gain that occurs with ruxolitinib. And it's a bit multifactorial. Certainly, there's the idea that patients are coming in with constitutional symptoms and weight loss. We're kind of adding this anti-inflammatory effect, and we're allowing some of that lack of weight loss, and that's a kind of a good weight gain that occurs, but there's also additional weight gain that occurs, and some of this may be from inhibiting leptin, which is the hormone that makes us feel full and can actually lead to weight gain through eating more. But there's also the fact that lipolysis that occurs in adipose tissue signals through JAK-STAT as well, and so you may kind of alter that equilibrium of burning fat or building fat and allow some weight gain to occur there as well. And so there's multiple different mechanisms that seem to play into the weight gain that's seen with ruxolitinib. Something we also have to think about is the increased risk of non-melanoma skin cancers. Hazard ratio here in this study that was published in a dermatology journal actually showed a hazard ratio between 2 and 3 of an increased risk of non-melanoma skin cancers. And I think this is something that we certainly recommend patients see dermatologists at least annually and keep an eye on this, but something that may factor into our treatment decisions as we have more JAK inhibitors approved and other non-JAK inhibitor modalities of therapy. This is a recently published experience of patients who developed non-melanoma skin cancer from our UK colleagues while receiving ruxolitinib. And I think what was interesting here is that just kind of showed the approach to patients with non-melanoma skin cancer. And by and large, about 2/3 of these patients really stayed on the same dose, no change in therapy. We kind of continued on the ruxolitinib. And I think what was a little bit sobering is that you look at around 8 of these 90 patients actually developed metastatic disease. And certainly, I think this is something that we may be underestimating the clinical significance of non-melanoma skin cancers that do occur during therapy with ruxolitinib. And lastly, we know that ruxolitinib does have an increased risk of developing zoster reactivation. A lot of this data comes from before the newer shingles vaccine, so it's unclear exactly how that impacts the development or the increased risk of shingles. We certainly recommend the newer shingles vaccine as well for our patients. Moving on from ruxolitinib, we have another JAK inhibitor. The second JAK inhibitor that was approved in 2019 was fedratinib, based on the results of the Jakarta study. Very similar data to what we saw in the COMFORT study. So fedratinib is very effective at reducing spleen size and symptoms compared to placebo in this study. We also know that the fedratinib has a second-line study from the Jakarta 2, or second-line data from Jakarta 2, that showed that patients who were on ruxolitinib who had intolerance or resistance to ruxolitinib were actually able to achieve high rates of spleen volume responses when moving to fedratinib. Now, there was a washout with this where patients had to come off of ruxolitinib for a little bit, but they were still able to achieve a significant rate of spleen volume responses when moving to second-line fedratinib. I think intriguingly, fedratinib has data in this odd kind of niche of patients with have moderate thrombocytopenia, so platelets between 50 and 100,000. This is a group of patients that was not enrolled or included on the COMFORT studies. However, they really represent a challenging group of patients where the label allows for using ruxolitinib in these patients, but at a very low dose that may be somewhat ineffective. Fedratinib actually was looked at on the Jakarta and Jakarta 2 studies in patients with moderate thrombocytopenia and showed impressive response rates in the 35 to 40% range in terms of spleen and symptoms. The FREEDOM 2 study was a second-line study that really recapitulated the data we saw in Jakarta 2. It randomized patients to fedratinib versus best available therapy in the second-line setting. And again, we saw very impressive spleen and symptom responses. I think importantly with Jakarta 2, or with FREEDOM 2, is where there was an alternative approach to managing some of the side effects, which we'll get into in a second. But I think the subgroup analysis that came from FREEDOM 2 is always intriguing, because the question is, you know, who is likely to benefit in the second line? And one of the things that came out was this group of patients that had moderate thrombocytopenia, so 50 to 100,000 platelets, again, coming as a group of patients that may be able to do. And maybe that's because we're able to fully dose on this study, fully dose fedratinib in this group of patients, while patients on ruxolitinib would have to be on a very maybe substandard dose. The other interesting subgroup analysis finding was that patients who were quote-unquote intolerant to ruxolitinib were the ones that were more likely to benefit. And I think that's important because these are JAK inhibitors. And so it's somewhat confusing to say that someone who's not benefiting from a JAK inhibitor could switch to a different JAK inhibitor with a similar mechanism of action and get a benefit. And so I think it's telling to show that the patients that were quote-unquote intolerant to ruxolitinib were really the ones to benefit. So these are people that are still likely to benefit from a JAK inhibitor-based approach. We'll get into some questions, but I think when we look at more relapse refractory to JAK inhibition at an optimal dose, we may be thinking about bringing alternative agents to the table in that group of patients. Now, certainly there's concerns with toxicity when it comes to fedratinib, and GI toxicity really comes up as the main concern. On the Jakarta studies, we saw rates of diarrhea, nausea, vomiting that were 40 to 50 to 60%. Obviously quite concerning. Rarely were these grade 3, but something that really does impact patients' lives when we're talking about that. One thing that I think was very encouraging from the FREEDOM 2 study is in this study, there was prophylactic aggressive antiemetic therapy, symptomatic antidiarrheal is what added, and that was able to significantly reduce the rates of nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea by about half across the board. So really something that if appropriately managed, we can really mitigate some of the side effects that come along with fedratinib. And I'd be remiss to mention that there is a black box warning that comes with fedratinib as well. This comes from the black box warning for encephalopathy, including Wernicke's. There was a reanalysis of these cases of suspected Wernicke's or encephalopathy that was done a few years ago. Suffice to say, there was a lot of patients that were on clinical development with fedratinib through a variety of different conditions, not just myelofibrosis, over 670 patients, and there were 8 patients that were treated for encephalopathy. You can see here that there was a lot of compromising or mitigating factors for some of these, but I think this is something that we do have to keep in the back of our heads when we're using fedratinib, and oftentimes we do need to check thiamine levels prior to putting patients on, and supplementing thiamine levels during treatment is one way to kind of avoid any issues with thiamine deficiency and potential encephalopathy. All right, and with that, I'll close, and we'll actually open up for some questions that have come in from our general medical oncologists and hematologists. Just overall, I wanted to kind of set the stage there on our approach to myelofibrosis in terms of patients that are not having significant cytopenias, but that will lead into some of our further discussion. So I'm going to bring in some of our colleagues now and discuss some questions that we have come in. So here we have a patient with intermediate risk myelofibrosis who receives ruxolitinib 15 milligrams twice daily. And after 10 months, he develops increasing asymptomatic splenomegaly. Platelet count's 150,000, hemoglobin's 13.8. He's not a transplant candidate. So I'll call first on our colleague, Dr. Bose. In this patient, what would you recommend as far as a treatment approach to this person? So again, rehashing, so 15 intermediate risk myelofibrosis on ruxolitinib, after 10 months starts developing kind of growth of the spleen with adequate blood counts. What are you thinking about doing for this patient?
Yeah, this would be a fairly straightforward fedratinib in my mind. I mean, you know, good blood counts, both platelets and hemoglobin are robust. The issue seems to be the spleen. We have great data. You just showed the Freedom 2, 36% SVR 35. I don't think we've seen that with any drug in the second line setting. So, fedratinib.
So, following up on that. So, between fedratinib versus increasing the dose of ruxolitinib, right? So, when we're thinking about that, how do you make a decision between switching to an alternative agent versus maybe increasing the ruxolitinib to 20 or 25 milligrams twice daily?
Yeah, thank you very much, Andrew. And it's great that we actually have two good options for this patient. So, as we evaluate response, spleen responses are very crucial for patients. A good marker, a good surrogate of how patients are doing, but also symptoms are also another pillar of response. So if the patient is doing well with symptoms and it's only the spleen, I think increasing ruxolitinib remains a reasonable option. This patient can go up to 20 twice a day or 25 twice a day for deeper responses if the other domains of care are actually addressed well.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is one of those cases where I'd say both are right, right? So we know that 15 milligrams twice daily is a pretty solid dose in terms of getting spleen volume responses. We know you probably have to get to at least 10 milligrams twice a day.
Correct.
Now, there's the potential for getting that increase in dose and getting a better response, but at the same time, you're thinking about secondary options as well. So oftentimes, these are patients where I'm talking to them about fedratinib, I'm increasing the dose, but we've already kind of set the stage for that discussion. If we're not seeing significant benefit with a dose increase, we're ready to move to a second line agent.
And it's a perfect patient for an add-on study.
Correct.
Great counts.
Yeah, I mean, we'll always kind of, I think we're all biased in terms of kind of promoting the idea of clinical trials. It's what we spend a lot of time doing. But I think, you know, clinical trials can really be viewed in any context with myelofibrosis. It's not just something in the relapse refractory cases. You know, we have clinical trials in the frontline setting and the add-on setting. And so there's always a good chance for patients to be on a clinical trial that could potentially, benefit them and benefit future patients as well. So moving on to the next question, which is going to be coming your way, Dr. Fleischman. So if a patient with symptomatic higher risk myelofibrosis did not experience reduction in spleen size or improvement in symptoms after 3 months of standard dose ruxolitinib, what would you most likely recommend, assuming normal renal function, hepatic function, and a platelet count that's greater than 200,000?
Okay, so in my mind, this looks somewhat similar to the first patient, other than this patient has never responded to ruxolitinib, and not clear what we can, probably was on a similar dose of ruxolitinib. From my standpoint, probably a similar approach. One could try to increase the dose of ruxolitinib at least initially to see if an increased dose will do the trick. Probably unlikely, but I think it's a reasonable first step. And then to also, as you mentioned, sort of setting the stage for switching JAK inhibitor. Since this person's counts seem to be quite robust, fedratinib seems like a reasonable second choice.
Yeah, so Prithvi, like, to me, this seems odd, right? I think that when you have a person on a standard dose of ruxolitinib and good counts, to really have no reduction in spleen size, I think that always raises a red flag to me, right? I think in practice, that makes me think, okay, well, one, are they taking the medication? Two, is there something else going on, right? Is there another alternative reason for splenomegaly? And I think that, you know, sometimes we, you know, I've seen very, odd, unexpected things. We do a bone marrow, we find hairy cell leukemia, right? Or something like that may be driving that, or maybe there's an alternative reason for that. But, you know, rarely there are patients that have this kind of refractory nature to their degree or to their disease. And I think what I've seen more frequently than not is that patients typically have some underlying mutation that may be a RAS pathway mutation or something like that may not be as responsive or may render the disease less responsive to JAK inhibition.
Or, you know, this is a patient, I mean, this is not a good sign, right? They are refractory to RUX, which is so rare, like you pointed out. And so what came to my mind reading this, again, with the clinical trials hat on, is that what if this is persistence and none of the type 1 JAK inhibitors will work? And we have now on the horizon the type, more than on the horizon, in the clinic actually, the type 2 JAK inhibitor. And I'm just intrigued what that might do for such a patient.
Yeah, absolutely. Certainly, you know, I think that you know, as we try to, and Angela will talk about kind of directions we're going in the future, as we try to kind of move the treatments forward for these diseases, you know, I think we can think about combinations or we can think about optimizing JAK inhibitors, right? And I think it's very exciting stuff that's coming into the clinic.
And another thing is it's labeling the person as high risk, but yet their counts, we don't know what their white count and whether they have blasts and what their hemoglobin is, but there must be another part of the story why they're higher risk.
Yeah, exactly. And as we said, like conflating risk and JAK inhibitor responsiveness are two very different things, right? And while like a lot of times if what makes you high risk is that you have a lot of blasts that are circulating around or you're very thrombocytopenic or very anemic, that may be a difficult person. But in this case, to have a higher risk person who has intact counts, clearly they must have symptoms, they may have other mutations or things like that that might be driving that risk. So Abe, which of the approved JAK inhibitors lead to an overall survival? This might be one of the questions that actually has a right answer, right? But which of the approved JAK inhibitors leads to a known overall survival benefit? And do any of them offer a greater OS benefit than the others?
All right, excellent. So again, based on the way the clinical trials have been completed, the only agent that had enough long follow-up where we can answer this question with evidence base is ruxolitinib. So ruxolitinib in two phase 3 randomized placebo-controlled studies with crossover allowed still showed overall survival advantage in the treatment arm in both studies and in the combination of studies. And that's really the only study that had long-term follow-up to answer that question. Many of the other studies or the other therapeutic options we have, unfortunately, the development was abbreviated due to clinical hold and we never got long-term follow-up to answer that.
So Angela, building on that, do you believe that the survival benefit we see with ruxolitinib is truly a class effect, or do you think it's something that is unique to ruxolitinib?
I mean, that's a very good question. I mean, my personal opinion is it probably is a class effect as opposed to something that's very specific for ruxolitinib that wouldn't apply to other JAK inhibitors. But again, that's just extrapolation, and I don't think that we have straightforward, clear clinical trial data to really pit one JAK inhibitor against each other with regard to overall survival.
Yeah, I kind of agree with you there. I believe it is a class effect. I also think it, you know, has to do with when the COMFORT studies were run, these patients were coming in very, very ill, right? And so it wasn't hard to necessarily move the needle in that group of patients because there was, when you look at spleen volumes on the COMFORT studies, they usually are much higher than what we're currently putting on clinical trials. And so I think we're in a different world now where it's going to be very difficult to show that overall survival benefit in this disease with a backbone of ruxolitinib. But I do tend to think that across the board, this is, you know, somewhat of a class effect. And certainly that makes sense for patients who may come in with anemia or thrombocytopenia, as we'll discuss, who may want to be on the agent that has an overall survival benefit, but maybe an alternative agent may be more appropriate for them, and so the fact that this is a class effect or could be a class effect is something that can help to alleviate those concerns. So Prithvi, how do you determine ruxolitinib failure, and at what point do you switch to a different JAK inhibitor? So, you know, I think this is a pretty broad question, but I guess the first one would be just how do you know when kind of it's time to move on from ruxolitinib?
You know, I wish there was a straightforward answer to this question. I mean, this is probably the most debated topic in this disease. But, you know, I think you get a sense of whether this is a suboptimal response or a complete failure. Like, we just saw two cases where one could be considered, you know, the first one, I think, I remember, like I was saying, you could look at an add-on agent because you get the sense that Rux is doing something, but not everything that you'd like it to do. And so, and that too is the more suboptimal, you know, concept. Failure was our second patient was a complete failure refractory, right? So, again, it's based on the usual, the spleen, symptoms, cytopenias worsening, blasts showing up, you know, things that tell you that this is not going well. And you have shown us with the RR6 that could be one objective way of telling that someone's not going to do so well after 6 months of Rux and something objective maybe to go by.
Yeah, I think when you're thinking about moving on from ruxolitinib, a lot of it comes down to what are your other options, right?
Correct.
And so with the RR6 model, where we identified that patients who don't get a suboptimal spleen response, patients that are maybe not able to get on the appropriate dose of ruxolitinib, you know, these can be factors that play into when it's time to switch. Well, if you have no other JAK inhibitors, then a lot of times we're going to push through, right? Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you know, now that we're getting newer JAK inhibitors that may be able to address some of those concerns, that maybe you have other options to move to. So I think that we are in a better spot than maybe we were a few years ago.
And I think we were doing the rechallenge too, right? There's mm-hmm. some data for rechallenge working when we didn't have the other options.
And speaking of rechallenge, like we'll move to Abe and talk about sequencing JAK inhibitors. I think this is a bit of a nuanced question, right? Mm-hmm. As far as how do you sequence them, and what would your approach be?
Yeah. So again, the fact that we do have available options that are high quality agents that are active even in the second line, almost all of the other agents have data in the second line setting after Rux failure. So really, we do have that luxury of we have multiple choices to pick from. And what I'm observing that in real life, most patients end up getting three or all four JAK inhibitors during their journey with myelofibrosis. So I think it's more of a more important than how we sequence them is that we're aware of all those agents and their attributes, and that we utilize them in the right patient or maybe in all of them at one point of time. Now, as we go through the program today, there are going to be agents with more preference in patients with anemia dominant presentation or thrombocytopenia dominant presentation, or such as fedratinib in patients with primary refractory and proliferative disease. So some of those clinical features might weigh in a little bit.
Yeah, I generally have a bit of a concern when we talk about sequencing, because I don't think it's the appropriate way to talk about it, right? I think when we talk about sequencing agents, a lot of times we're talking about what we do with solid tumors, where we get a complete response, right? The disease goes away, and then it comes back, and you switch to a different agent that has a different mechanism of action to come in and see if we can kind of get control of the malignancy in through a different way. These are all JAK inhibitors, right?
Correct.
So we're not moving from what we're not, and we're not getting complete responses.
Correct.
Right? So I think instead of sequencing, we should be talking about kind of optimizing, right? And it's picking the right JAK inhibitor for the right patient at the right time. And so that may be starting with ruxolitinib, but it may be moving to momelotinib when anemia develops, or moving to pac{Pregnant} with thrombocytopenia develops, and then maybe moving back if some of the symptoms aren't as well controlled when you make that switch, right? And
Correct.
So I think it's trying to say that all of these are options, and you're trying to target the right patient with the right agent.
And also recognizing the lack of benefit. So for patients on therapy that is not working or the doses cannot be optimized, probably time to take a turn and change therapy.
Yeah, and I think it's important to kind of understand what your goal is, right? That's a that's a shared decision with the patient, right? What are we trying to achieve with this agent? If we achieve that, good, we've hit our goals. If we don't achieve that, let's go back and talk about what we're trying to do with a treatment change. So quickly, as Angela, do you see any difference between primary myelofibrosis versus kind of post-ET or post-PV myelofibrosis and as far as the approach to treatment?
To answer that question, I think that not necessarily because they were labeled as primary versus secondary, but in general, like a post-PV myelofibrosis patient may have higher counts, will have sort of a more robust CBC profile. So those may be somebody, a group of patients where you can, they'll tolerate a little bit more cytoreductive drug, whereas a primary myelofibrosis patient may come to one's attention because they've presented with anemia, and so need to have considerations in terms of drugs that won't worsen their cytopenias for that patient population. I'm wondering if that's what you were asking.
Yeah, I think that yeah. Obviously all of these big clinical trials that led to the approvals of our JAK inhibitors really included both primary and secondary myelofibrosis mm-hmm. patients. And so largely it doesn't really impact, I think, our decision making when we're choosing them. However, there are some correlations with those diseases. They're a bit different, right, in terms of how they act. I will say secondary MF patients typically have fewer of these additional mutations. Mm-hmm. And so in some ways you may think that they have a better chance of responding because they have a little bit fewer of the high risk mutations that go along with that. But I think overall we can view them very similarly as we approach them. Prithvi, if fedratinib is pretty standardly a started dose of 400 milligrams daily, what's your usual starting dose for ruxolitinib? Do you follow the label as far as, hey, whatever the platelet count is, that's the dose that I'm going to recommend, or do you have a different way of doing it?
I try to follow the label. Of course, I think the realize strategy that you showed is very helpful for anemic patients, but in general, I follow the label because I believe that it's a very dose-dependent drug. The best spleen response you can get depends on the dose, the best dose you can give, and that is tied to survival. So I try my best to optimize the dose and start with the best dose.
So I do want to get to a couple of the questions that came in from the audience today. And I'll save some of these for actually a later discussions because some are more appropriate there. But in patients that have myelofibrosis but lack a JAK2 mutation, does that impact your decision to use a JAK inhibitor, Abe?
All right, thank you very much. So when the COMFORT study was designed and conducted, we did not even recognize the other mutations. Myelofibrosis was JAK2 positive or JAK2 negative. But now, again, there are two other driver mutations that have been recognized since then. And we understand that JAK's pathway inhibitors are not selective to JAK2 mutation. So in all patients, regardless of the driver mutations or lack thereof, the response rate has been consistently the same with JAK inhibitors. The only unique pearl about triple negative MPNs is that generally they have higher risk biology, higher risk of progression. Those are patients you might want to monitor more often. They probably end up doing more bone marrow biopsies for disease surveillance, for transformation, but not necessarily for the choice of the JAK inhibitor.
Yeah, I think I certainly agree with you on that. And I think we have time for one more question. Angela, you're the lucky one who gets this one. And so if you have a patient with intermediate one risk disease by DIPSS, low risk kind of overall type patient, doesn't have cytopenias or constitutional symptoms, really not prominent splenomegaly, is there any benefit in starting a JAK inhibitor early on to get ahead of things?
So if you want my personal opinion,
I do, yes.
My personal opinion is no.
Okay.
Obviously I always discuss it with the patient, but I think it is also important to discuss the side effects of drugs. So if there's nothing to gain in terms of splenomegaly or symptoms, really I discuss with the patient data from clinical trials, and we do discuss the potential of overall survival benefit with ruxolitinib, and then I discuss the side effect profile and allow the patient to make the decision on their own.
I tend to agree with you as well. I think the benefits we've seen with ruxolitinib are really in patients that came in with some degree of splenomegaly and symptoms, so it's hard to extrapolate that to patients without those types of symptoms. So with that, we'll close module one, and I'll introduce a esteemed colleague, Dr. Bose, to take us over with module two.
Thanks, Andrew. So my topic, as you can see here, is thrombocytopenia, and I was asked to cover that as well as pacritinib. And so let's get right into it. This is a busy slide, sorry about that, but this is actually quite conceptually important, so I'll spend a little time on this. Over the last, let's say, 5-ish years, I think we've become more and more aware, appreciative of these two flavors, as I like to call it, of the disease, cytopenic or myelodepletive, which I think was the better term, but cytopenic is what is used more. So cytopenic MF and then myeloproliferative phenotype. So two different phenotypes at two ends of a spectrum. Again, this is more of a concept. You cannot fit patients into watertight compartments. But what you see is that in myeloproliferative, in that flavor, you see higher counts, bigger spleen, higher JAK2 allele burdens, a better prognosis, less leukemic transformation, less fibrosis, less of these other mutations, and an overrepresentation of post-PV and post-ET MF patients. In the myelodepletive or cytopenic phenotype, again, you see the reverse. You see lower counts, as the name would suggest. You see smaller spleens, lower JAK2 allele burden. We don't know this for CALR and MPL, but we know it about JAK2, so lower JAK2 allele burden. Bunch of other mutations, which you know are not good actors. Worse prognosis, higher leukemic transformation, more fibrosis, and more patients, and more of these patients have primary MF. And so this is sort of conceptually, I think, allowed us to appreciate that you know, the disease really does have different shades to it. And then if you look at the very bottom of the slide, that is a very general statement, but I think there is reason to feel that pacritinib and momelotinib are more geared or more suited for these cytopenic patients, whereas ruxolitinib and fedratinib are more suited for the proliferative patients, although it's important to point out that momelotinib has a lot of data in the proliferative patients as well. So, and this is important because, you know, cytopenic MF has worse outcomes. So like I said, their survival is worse, they get more leukemic transformation. So this was a study just to objectify things. This is from Italy, and they looked at, they defined cytopenic MF, as you can see, with any one of these cytopenias as shown, white cells, hemoglobin, and platelets. And basically, they looked at prefibrotic MF, which we won't discuss today, as well as overt primary myelofibrosis, and showed that the cytopenic MF had a worse outcome. And it was, it was bad if it was one cytopenia and worse if it was two or more. So thrombocytopenia is obviously a common problem. It is it's a difficult thing to improve. I think it's a little easier to improve anemia than it is to improve thrombocytopenia. And obviously, it can affect dosing of drugs, Rux being the prime example. So this is a work from on the left, actually both these papers authored by my colleague, Dr. Masarova. One showing our experience on the left, you know, in these newly diagnosed patients at presentation, about 11% with platelets less than 50, and three quarters with good platelets that would, let's say, be in line with the comfort trials, et cetera, which is 100 and higher. And then the pie chart sort of in the middle is a recall-based survey, I believe, of European hematologists, which is more of a snapshot, just how many of your patients have platelets less than 50, 50 to 100, and over 100. And you can see that it was about roughly one-third each. And then also to the right, work from our institution showing that, low platelets is really a bad actor in terms of survival, with the 15-month curve being the one for less than 50,000. So this is a slide that shows, now that we have four drugs, gives you an idea of the different targets and what is inhibited more or less by each drug. So as you can see, ruxolitinib and momelotinib are the two JAK1 and JAK2 inhibitors, with not much appreciable difference between their relative inhibition of JAK1 and JAK2. Whereas with pacritinib and fedratinib, particularly pacritinib, that's really all JAK2 with no JAK1, fedratinib, some JAK1, but mostly JAK2. There's also, dashed lines with the deeper or lighter shading suggesting greater or lesser inhibition. And this tells you that at least in one study, preclinical, pacritinib was a more potent inhibitor of ACVR1, which, of course, again, is different from the clinical data. But in this preclinical study, it was a more potent inhibitor of ACVR1 than momelotinib. So a little bit more on that. So pacritinib completely spares JAK1. It is a JAK2 inhibitor. We were initially taught, I think the classical thinking was that hitting JAK1 is important for symptom control, although I think as we look at the data with fedratinib and pacritinib, we come to appreciate that that may not be necessarily the case, and maybe you can control symptoms without JAK1. Important to note that pacritinib does inhibit IRAK1 in the toll-like receptor innate immunity pathway, which could help explain how it controls symptoms despite not inhibiting JAK1. And then something that has evolved is that perhaps its lack of myelosuppression is tied to not inhibiting JAK1, because doing so may inhibit platelet release. PERSIST-1 was the first phase 3 trial of pacrithinib. This is not talked about as much, mainly because the dose here was 400 once a day, not the 200 BID approved dose. But just quickly, this is a frontline study, JAK inhibitor naive, and the control arm could not include JAK inhibitors. And here are the endpoints. Overall, you know, the top panel, SVR 35, lower panel, TSS 50, the outcomes we are used to at 24 weeks. And you see here that it was positive for spleen, not quite for symptoms. Although if you look at the evaluable population or if you look at the ITT population, but at week 48, then it was positive for symptoms as well. PERSIST-2 is the much more important study and the pivotal study that led to its approval. This was done in patients with platelets less than 100, so the sort of the mirror image of the COMFORT studies, completely different population. And furthermore, this was not a frontline population, or at least not all of it. You had patients who could have had prior ruxolitinib. About 40-some percent had had prior ruxolitinib, so it was not just all frontline with a significant proportion of second line patients in terms of prior JAK inhibitor exposure. There were two pacritinib dosing arms, as you can see, the 200 BID, which is the approved dose, and the 400 once a day. And BAT arm, the comparator arm, could include ruxolitinib, but obviously because of the platelet restriction on this study, those were not patients getting very optimal doses of ruxolitinib. These are mostly 5 or 10 milligrams a day. And this was a positive study. If you look at the 200 BID, just to be factually correct, if you looked at the pooled pacritinib in totality and compared it to the BAT, then it was positive for spleen but not for symptoms. But if you looked at the 200 BID alone, it was positive for both spleen and symptoms, and these were co-primary endpoints. So just a little bit more on this to show you that in this very difficult population of less than 50 platelets where we know Rux has not been studied, fedratinib has not been studied, this drug really gives you equally good, sometimes even better response rates than in the whole study population, which was up to 100. We talked about the ACVR1 piece. So as you know, this is best known for the anemia benefits of momelotinib, which inhibits ACVR1 and downregulates hepcidin. So does pacritinib. Remember, I told you in one preclinical study, it was actually a more potent inhibitor of ACVR1. And what this is showing you is from the PERSIST-2 study, the pivotal trial, that if you took the non-transfusion independent patients, and you looked at their conversion to transfusion independence over 12 weeks, any 12 weeks, with no hemoglobin less than 8, then you had 24% for pacritinib and 5% for BAT, which included the low-dose ruxolitinib. This is about dose intensity. Andrew made the point that with ruxolitinib, it's really important, or with any drug, it's really important to be able to dose it optimally. And what this is showing you is that if you looked at PERSIST-2, remember there were some patients there that got Rux as their BAT, as their comparator. And then there were patients who had had prior Rux and those who were Rux naive. So if you just looked at PAC versus Rux in the Rux naive patients, which really made the comparator arm very small. But if you looked at those patients, you could see that the pacritinib dose intensity was much easier to maintain. And then more on that same comparison, PAC versus Rux in Rux-naive patients from PERSIST-2. Again, small numbers, but numerically higher rates of spleen and symptom response, which I think is not a surprise because, again, you're comparing to very low doses of ruxolitinib. Now, we've always learned, actually from ruxolitinib, that there is a correlation between shrinking the spleen and a survival benefit. And we know that spleen responders live longer, and the deeper the spleen response, the better the survival. And we've all gotten used to this 35% spleen volume reduction in the field as a whole, starting as a regulatory endpoint and then pretty much the benchmark with which we compare studies. Now, PERSIST-2 showed that actually 10% in the context of pacritinib, 10% SVR was actually their best cutoff for that correlation with survival. Anemia and thrombocytopenia often occur in the same patients. They coexist more often than not. And so this was a study, again, a look at the PERSIST-2 data showing that in these bicytopenic patients, you still have that retained efficacy of pacritinib. Adverse events, pacritinib does cause significant diarrhea, 48% of patients. Thankfully, this is only within the first 8 weeks. It's not been a huge problem in my own experience, but of course they should be counseled to have antidiarrheals on hand. There was a full clinical hold on this drug that was lifted within a year of being imposed, and that was to do with bleeding and cardiovascular mortality, which those fears have been allayed. There was a study called the PAC-203 study done, which was specifically done to show the safety, and with careful patient selection and mitigation strategies, you did not see those concerns. Pacifica is still enrolling outside the U.S. This is the confirmatory phase 3 study. As you know, pacritinib is only approved currently in the U.S., and its label is for patients with platelets less than 50. So that is the population for Pacifica. As you can see here, patient platelets less than 50, JAK inhibitor naive, or pretreated for a limited duration. And this is pacritinib versus BAT. To their credit, they do allow ruxolitinib as the BAT, again, low dose, because obviously those are very low platelets, but still this is really nice, because again, ruxolitinib has not been studied under in less than 50 platelets, but here we've all done that when we had to, or in fact, you know, still might, and this allows that choice in the comparator arm. Just one slide here, to be fair, as we discuss thrombocytopenia, kind of the whole spectrum. Momelotinib has been studied as well in patients with low platelets, especially in the Momentum study, going down to platelets of 25. In Simplify 2, actually, there was no lower limit, but there are patients really in that 25 to 50 space. I think something like 27 or so patients in that less than 50 space between the two studies, and then many more in the less than 100 space. What you're seeing here is that momelotinib does retain its efficacy, although I will say that it can cause some thrombocytopenia, as I'm sure Abe will discuss. In my personal opinion, in the less than 50, I think I would tend to go with pacritinib, which has more data, and I think is less myelosuppressive. I will end with that. Andrew, turn it over to you.
Wonderful. All right. Well, you kind of, in that last statement, you really took, you really kind of answered this first question, as you said, that really in the less than 50,000 platelets that your personal opinion would be to go with pacritinib. So I'll change this question a little bit, but I'm going to come back to you. So a patient presents with primary myelofibrosis, constitutional symptoms, splenomegaly, has a baseline platelet count of 51,000. All right. Patient's not a transplant candidate. What treatment would you likely recommend for that patient?
I think still pacritinib.
Okay. 52,000. No, okay. So, I mean, building on it, is there a cutoff, right, where you feel like there's a platelet count where, you know, there may be an alternative choice there? And what is that threshold?
Yeah, for me, it's like, do they have anemia, right? If anemia is an overriding concern, then I'm certainly thinking very seriously about momelotinib. But then I'm looking at the platelets. And if they're less than 50 or 51 or 52, I think I'll stay with pacritinib. But I think if, obviously there's no signs to this, but if it's a little bit more, a little bit healthier, you know, 60s, 70s and higher, I'll probably go with momelotinib if there's anemia.
Yeah, I think certainly some of these thresholds are helpful in practice, but also they're a little bit restrictive as well.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you may try to get approval for the 51,000 patient platelet or platelet patient, and you might have a little bit of trouble doing that, or at least require a little bit more work to do that. So why? I mean, you kind of alluded to this, but what, in your opinion, why do you think pacritinib is better than ruxolitinib or fedratinib with severe thrombocytopenia? Is it IRAK1? Is it the lack of JAK1? What's your opinion? Does it matter?
Maybe it's both or one of those. I mean, those are the two unique attributes, right? No JAK1 at all. And if we believe that that you know, plays into this platelet release story, perhaps that is why. And then the IRAK1 as well. I don't think anyone really knows.
No. I mean, I'd say, you know, when we have clinical data, right, it kind of obviates the rationale or the
correct,
mechanism.
Yeah.
But as we develop new agents, it's helpful to know why, yeah. right? Because then we can kind of optimize the development of newer agents if we're trying to get them to do something very specific, right?
Yeah, and also maybe the dose density, you can deliver it.
All right, so we got another case. This one's coming at you, Abe. So 55-year-old patient presents with fatigue, drenching night sweats, weight loss, bone pain, and a spleen measurement of 20 centimeters with significant abdominal symptoms, and she's diagnosed with myelofibrosis. Platelet count's 44,000, hemoglobin's 8.1, white blood cell count 36,000 with 2% blast. Genomic profiling shows the presence of JAK2, TET2, ASXL1 mutations. What treatment would you recommend?
All right, so these are the patients that really represent the classic challenges. They do have high burden symptoms that you want to address. They do have a really significant spleen that needs to be addressed, so you really need the JAK pathway inhibition for that benefit. On the other hand, you are starting with significant cytopenias, except for the Y count, and the, you know, so really he probably meets all the high-risk features in that sense, and having high-risk mutation. So on label, pactinib remains the first go-to drug in these patients. And we have the data from that Dr. Bhatt just presented about the efficacy and responses in those patients. Obviously, on a short path to a transplant, hopefully, in a patient with that high risk of a profile. And we've also discussed the response rates with pacritinib, and they're definitely not 100%, so there is a chance this patient would receive effective therapy that doesn't meet all the goals. And for that situation, momelotinib would be right on label for this patient. So it would be another option that you could deliver over here. Maybe a point of contention with Dr. Bhatt, but I think both would be something you can deliver.
Which patient. One are you going to do?
Probably start with pacritinib on this
okay.
patient. Yeah. Right.
Angela, what do you think?
I mean, I agree, but I think the main point here is this person is somebody you're quite concerned about, that their sort of end game needs to be transplant. And really, from my mind, how are we going to successfully get them to transplant is my major goal. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, you need to reduce the spleen size and make them feel better, and you would like not to make their counts any worse than they already are, but taking that all into perspective, that the final goal is to get this person to transplant and have them cured before they progress to an acute leukemia.
Broadly, I mean, so building on that, so broadly speaking, if the goal is transplant for someone, does that change how you treat them necessarily? I mean, are there any nuances?
I mean, on
there?
One hand, you care what you do to their counts if all you want to do is get them prepped up for transplant as soon as possible. I mean, this is person's peripheral blood, I'm assuming. We don't know what their bone marrow blasts are, but this just looks like a very concerning situation here.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think the only change I would say, it doesn't necessarily alter the treatment that I would give if you're thinking about going to transplant, but it does alter kind of how aggressive you can be with treatment, I think. And so if you're talking about a short window to transplant, you know, you could maybe, you know, be more aggressive in what you're trying to accomplish and understand that maybe if you're going to induce transfusion dependency, it's only a short period of time before mm-hmm. you're able to move there.
Correct.
And you don't want to sacrifice maybe that spleen response that could convey a better outcome with transplant. Prithvi, any thoughts on your end on that?
Oh, this is clearly a very high-risk patient on multiple levels. And so, yeah, start with PAC. I mean, there is anemia. There is that anemia benefit of PAC as well, less than 50. They have the most data. Yeah, start with that. Try to get to transplant.
Wonderful. All right, we're going with another case. Here we got Abe. I'll come to you first with this one. So a patient with symptomatic higher-risk myelofibrosis and splenomegaly, baseline platelet counts 110,000, receives ruxolitinib 15 milligrams twice daily in response with significant symptom improvement, decrease in spleen size. 3 years later, they present with drenching night sweats, fatigue, abdominal discomfort, and an increase in spleen size. Platelet counts now 44,000, hemoglobin's 11.2. Patient is not a transplant candidate. So what would you do in this case?
All right, so excellent. So this actually is a very realistic situation, because that's almost what happens in most of our patients. And this is really a good reminder of what we're doing for our patients. We're delivering therapy that is effective, but in one sense it's also palliative and supportive, and progression is inevitable. And that's why we really keep advocating for clinical trials, because we don't really have enough tools for this patient or others to help them out of that situation. But this patient had successful therapy and a durable response for that matter, and now has progressed with cytopenias. So step number one, I would like to do a bone marrow biopsy to evaluate what actually is the engine for this new progression? Has there been any more genomic instability or other targetable mutations? Is there a blast phase going on in that patient? So that'd be step number one. And if our goal is also a JAK inhibition with the intent to reduce the spleen size and the symptoms, I think this patient also would benefit from pactinib in this line of therapy. As we also, again, there's no transplant option, so it's more palliative therapy with pac![tr]etinib.
Yeah, I think certainly this is a very realistic case, right, of someone who derived a great benefit from ruxolitinib, but over time, you know, that benefit waned, and certainly that's the benefit of having alternative agents that we can switch to. So kind of nailing down some of the details of pac�tinib, you know, when we're talking about starting patients with severe thrombocytopenia on packvětinib, Angela, what could we expect, right, as far as the likelihood of achieving improvement in the spleen, improvement in symptoms, you know, when you're talking with a patient about maybe the patient that Abe just kind of referenced, right, the person who's switching over, you know, what would you say, like, what are patients likely to experience?
So this is somebody who has had an initial response to, for example, ruxolitinib.
Correct. Yeah.
And now it's, I mean, what I would tell, obviously you can't guarantee anything to the patient, but say based in clinical trials, you know, a lot of the clinical trials did have patients who were failed one JAK inhibitor and did respond to a second JAK inhibitor. So we can be hopeful that you will have a good response and you'll enjoy again the response that you had when you first started ruxolitinib. I'm not going to give the patient a number, but I clearly paint a rosy picture in terms of it's worth a try.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think whenever I'm sitting with patients talking about this transition, you're like, the goal of this is really to improve quality of life, right? And you know, that's what we're going to try to accomplish. The data suggests that's possible with this approach, but at the same time, we're going to check in, you know, 4 weeks, 6 weeks, and kind of see if we're hitting our marks there. Prithvi, so any kind of nuances to the dosing of pacritinib here? Is it pretty standard with 200 milligrams BID? Are you adjusting doses based on anemia, thrombocytopenia?
Yeah, I actually never have. I've always only done 200 BID. In fact, in the PAC 203, they saw no activity at the lower doses. Now, if the patient is going from Rux, then what I do with both PAC and fedratinib is that I overlap for a week with low-dose Rux because they have the long half-lives and don't hit JAK1. And so there's this concern for rebound, right, or Rux discontinuation syndrome. So I will overlap 5 BID of Rux for a week with fedratinib or pacritinib. There is no reason, though, to do that with momelotinib.
Right. So you can kind of do it directly. We did have a question come in talking about how switching over, but to reemphasize what Prithvi was saying is certainly with longer acting JAK inhibitors, if you're switching from Rux over, there can be an overlap for a few days. With momelotinib, you can switch directly from Rux over to momelotinib without that overlap. So we have some time for a couple questions coming in from the audience. So, based upon, kind of what we saw in PERSIST-2, is there a reason to think that in someone who's maybe on 15 milligrams twice daily of ruxolitinib who develops thrombocytopenia, is there a time where you would consider just decreasing the dose of ruxolitinib versus switching to pacritinib? And I think with the PERSIST-2, this kind of speaks to that in some way, shape, or form, right? Because patients were randomized to best available therapy, which could include ruxolitinib. But how would you approach someone, and what's a dose where you would say, no, I in this case, I decrease the dose. In this case, I would maybe switch over to a new agent. Abe, any thoughts there?
Yeah, so to the literal answer to your question, if somebody is on 15 milligrams of Rux and tolerating it with manageable thrombocytopenia, as long as they're not bleeding or, you know, requiring transfusions or platelets, I think that's very fair therapy, but successful therapy. I probably would not challenge that patient. But again, as we start titrating on rocks, if you're down to 10, if you're down to 5, then we probably it's time to switch therapy. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that certainly has to do with, right, the patient's responding, are they losing response? Because, you know, I think we have this magic number of 50 sometimes, right? But in someone who's doing well with platelets of 45,000, I mean, maybe that's someone you just continue on that therapy if it's stable. Now, if the platelets are dropping quickly, that's a different scenario, right? And you may have to adjust to that. Angela, do you ever see as a goal of therapy trying to raise the platelet count?
No, I mean, other than you would like to avoid if their platelets are very low and they were concerned about the potential of bleeding, I guess then the the concern is you do want to raise the platelet count, but I wouldn't necessarily say that's the goal of therapy. We would like to avoid thrombocytopenia is maybe a same thing, but just a different way to put it.
Yeah, and to that end, Prithvi, would you expect starting someone on pacritinib for their platelet count to go up?
It can. I've seen it occasionally. I've heard colleagues say that it happens. Yeah. It's not common. It's certainly not what the graphs from the trials would suggest, but I think it's more anecdotal. But I wanted to add, Andrew, that as we've seen the field evolve, right, at least for me, when you drop to less than 50, given what we know about the importance of dosing with Rux and dose intensity and all that, and I showed you the PAC versus Rux sort of dose intensity graphs from PERSIST-2, I think in the less than 50, now I'm less inclined to persist with low-dose Rux. Rux is a fantastic drug if you can give it at a good dose, right? So I think I'm more inclined now in the less than 50 space to switch that patient to PAC.
Wonderful. All right. Well, with that, I think we have time to move over to our next presentation, which will be given by Dr. Abe Yacoub, talking about myelofibrosis patients with anemia.
All right. Thank you very much, Andrew. And it's officially good afternoon. So I'm going to be discussing the management of patients with myelofibrosis with anemia and maybe discuss anemia and myelofibrosis. So let's go over the issue at hand. So anemia, as everybody who is managing myelofibrosis has a healthy respect of the impact of anemia as a barrier of care or as a challenge in treating patients with myelofibrosis. So anemia is common, and it gets more and more prevalent in patients with myelofibrosis the longer they live with their disease. As we showed similar data for thrombocytopenia, myelofibrosis is a progressive disease, and anemia can only get worse with time, and patients will become more and more anemic, and that's why we should have strategies to deal with anemia and myelofibrosis. Also, transfusion requirements tend to increase with time, so that is also a challenge in increasing supportive care and healthcare demands for patients with anemia. So in addition to being a logistical problem, anemia is also a prognostic problem. Patients with anemia have worse survival and worse prognosis. And the worse the anemia, the worse the survival, as you can see on the graph on the right. And then once you get to transfusion dependence, that's a different level of worse prognosis. So that's an even further step towards poor outcomes. So really, anemia is a situation that has become heightened. We had heightened awareness for anemia and the challenges with myelofibrosis therapy, which led to the NCCN getting together and trying to provide some guidance. So we've always made decisions on patients with proliferative symptoms, spleen and symptoms, you have to control these. Thrombocytopenia is our biggest decision-making regarding which JAK inhibitors are appropriate and which are not. But then now anemia is becoming more visible as the goal of care. And we are adjusting our therapy now based on the anemia, as you've concluded from our discussion today. So in patients who have proliferative myelofibrosis, who are on JAK inhibitor therapy, who are meeting their goals of care, but they're still anemic, the guidelines pivot towards adding more anemia-directed therapy by using agents that are listed in this slide. You have danazol, luspatercept, and others that we can deliver to work on the anemia while the other JAK inhibitor is actively working. On the other hand, in patients on JAK inhibitor therapy that are not getting the appropriate spleen reduction, symptom improvement, maybe ruxolitinib therapy shouldn't be their first-line therapy. So maybe there's a direction in which there's some recommendation that you would start with JAK inhibitors that have more favorable anemia profile. So that has become a new trend and a new recommendation from our guideline bodies. So let's talk about the anemia story. So anemia has always been recognized as a challenge. These are the anemia data from the COMFORT studies. So as you notice with ruxolitinib, it's our first JAK inhibitor that resulted in significant clinical benefit in patients. Anemia was recognized early on, particularly the early anemia, the first dip, and then patients do have some recovery, but they still have a lower hemoglobin compared to the control arm. But this is treatment-related anemia. We know that discontinuation of ruxolitinib might result in resolution of this anemia. We also observed that patients on Rux require more transfusions. And on reporting adverse events, anemia was almost universal on the study. And high-grade anemia occurred in about 40 to 50% of patients on the study. But because of the design of the study, there was no discontinuation for anemia. So the paradigm has been to treat patients through anemia and to support patients for the anemia. And the results from that is that unlike disease-related anemia that is of poor prognosis and poor outcome, treatment-related anemia from ruxolitinib was not. So patients who had anemia while on the COMFORT study enjoyed the same level of splenic volume response, enjoyed the same level of symptom improvement, and enjoyed nearly the same overall survival. So the paradigm has been, is as we deliver drugs as our only JAK inhibitor that is approved, that we treat through anemia, we muscle through anemia, we support patients with anemia therapy and transfusions, and that actually pays off into high response rates and similar survival. However, that is a lot of supportive care and a lot of management of patients to be able to deliver anemia. And once you get to transfusion dependence, really the quality of life becomes significantly detrimental, but that was the era when we had no other options. And then with the discovery of, or the introduction of the other JAK inhibitors that have different mechanisms of actions, pacritinib and momelotinib, and as Dr. Boss kind of mentioned or commented on some of this, so these agents have other kinase activity in which they inhibit activin receptor. So activin receptor is not in the bone marrow, it's in the liver, it is involved in the production of hepcidin. As we're all aware, hepcidin can cause anemia, and in patients with myelofibrosis, at least some patients with myelofibrosis, although the anemia is multifactorial, but hepcidin can contribute to the anemia from myelofibrosis. And by blocking activin receptor, reducing hepcidin, some patients will get anemia benefit, and that's what we observed in the clinical trial. And momelotinib and pacritinib are both agents that can induce that. And that was the rationale, and that's where the paradigm shift in managing patients with myelofibrosis and anemia. So the first clue came from the Simplify 1 and Simplify 2 study. So the Simplify 1 was a progressive study that compared momelotinib against ruxolitinib head-to-head in treatment-naive patients and allowed crossover, and the goal was to prove non-inferiority. The outcome from this study, which we continue to quote for our patients after the FDA approval, is that momelotinib was not inferior to ruxolitinib in spleen volume reduction. So for patients where that's a domain that we need to focus on, momelotinib is a very good agent in that sense. But momelotinib was not inferior to ruxolitinib for symptom improvement. So ruxolitinib came out the winner on the symptom domain. And based on this, the study did not meet that endpoint, and momelotinib was not approved based on this data. However, a strong observation from this study is that there was a very notable anemia benefit in patients who received momelotinib compared to patients receiving ruxolitinib, with fewer transfusion independence patients on patients who started with momelotinib and also on patients who started with ruxolitinib and crossed over to momelotinib, that there was an anemia benefit, and this anemia benefit and transfusion independence was durable. And that really was a first phenomenon that was observed in which we actually can deliver JAK inhibitors and not induce anemia or maybe improve the hemoglobin, which led to the design of this dedicated registration study, the MOMENTUM study, in which momelotinib was compared to danazol in patients who have myelofibrosis, have had previous therapy, and continue to be symptomatic and anemic. So those patients were randomized to momelotinib versus danazol with crossover allowed, and with multiple primary and secondary endpoints, but a key secondary endpoint was transfusion independence. So anemia was, for the first time, a key secondary endpoint in a prospective randomized study, and the study, as everybody's aware, was positive for the primary endpoint and nearly all the secondary endpoints, leading to the FDA approval of momelotinib. So what we observed is that there is, whichever way we measure anemia, the momelotinib came as the winner over danazol. So on this slide, you see transfusion independence conversion, and danazol has showed some anemia benefit in transfusion independence conversion, but momelotinib induced more than that. And as you can see in the graph, danazol was not placebo. So patients who received danazol in the gray graph actually had improvement in their hemoglobin, but patients who received momelotinib had even more improvement in the hemoglobin. And after crossover on the second part of the graph, patients who crossed over from danazol to momelotinib actually caught up with the momelotinib patients, which really confirms that momelotinib has a genuine anemia gain over other therapy, including danazol, which really consolidated the role of momelotinib as a JAK inhibitor of choice in patients who are anemic and symptomatic. So long-term safety for momelotinib. So there's over 700 patients which were enrolled in the momelotinib studies, and they were followed for over 1,000 person years. We have very good understanding of the hematologic and non-hematologic adverse events of momelotinib, which seem to be very well tolerated, really. And then, as you can notice on this table, the adverse events decrease significantly with long-term exposure. So as patients are on therapy long-term, you see a lot fewer adverse events, a lot more very well tolerated going forward. And the one adverse event that stands out from momelotinib is increased risk of infection. So that's something we need to be aware of and educate the patients about as we deliver momelotinib for our patients. So with that being redundant, we're not going to go over the design and the execution of the PERSIST-2 study that led to the pacενib approval, but I would like to reiterate the anemia benefit that was observed with the pacενib use, which we also attribute to the activin receptor inhibition. So whichever way we measure anemia, whether it's transfusion independence, increase in hemoglobin, reduction in transfusion requirements, By all measures, pacritinib happened to be the winner arm over the best available therapy, including ruxolitinib, in that study. In more modern retrospective analyses in that study, transfusion independence or transfusion independence conversion rate was higher in pacritinib compared to the best available therapy, with a 37% conversion, which is really an interesting large number in this setting. And then for patients who did not become transfusion independent, there was 50% reduction in the transfusion needs. Really, a lot of data supporting pacritinib being an active myelofibrosis therapy in patients who have myelofibrosis and anemia that could result in myelofibrosis benefit and anemia benefit. More recently, we're also emphasizing anemia-directed therapy in myelofibrosis. So if the patients are getting successful myelofibrosis therapy, the addition of anemia drugs has been tested and has been rewarding. So luspatercept is an agent that is already approved in MDS in first line and beyond. The mechanism of action has been validated over and over in multiple diseases and multiple clinical trials and has shown consistent anemia benefit. And it was studied in a randomized phase 2 study in myelofibrosis in which patients who are receiving therapy with Rux or not Rux therapy, who are anemic and transfusion dependent or not transfusion dependent, luspatercept showed activity in anemia gain, particularly in the cohorts where ruxolitinib was being delivered and also patients who were transfusion dependent. So this phase 2 study led to the design of a dedicated phase 3 study, the independence study, in which patients with myelofibrosis and anemia on ruxolitinib are randomized to receive luspatercept or a placebo with the endpoint of achieving transfusion independence. Hopefully, this would result in continuation of the JAK inhibitor and more successful therapy. So we've made a lot of success in designing clinical trials to test anemia and myelofibrosis, and now we have a few agents to discuss in this domain. Thank you.
Wonderful, Abe. Thanks so much. And we are now over officially, as you said, we're officially afternoon. We're officially over halfway through this. So now it's time to ramp up the provocative nature of the questions.
All right.
Okay. So so we got a few cases that we can present initially, and then we have some audience questions that came in as well. So we'll start with these. And Abe, I'll start with you, given the fact that you just gave the presentation on anemia. But you have a 65-year-old patient, higher risk symptomatic myelofibrosis, splenomegaly, transfusion-dependent anemia. What would you generally recommend, assuming the patient is not a transplant candidate?
Yeah, so I think at this time and era, again, although we would like to deliver JAK inhibitor therapy because of the spleen and symptoms, but we also do want to have the anemia benefit, and momelotinib seems to be the preferred choice in a lot of those patients at this point. Because in addition, you know, even though we don't have the overall survival data as we have with ROX, but again, transfusion dependence is a lot of work and a poor quality of life, and improving anemia is a big unmet need for these patients.
And Angela, coming to you on the next one. So now you have an 80-year-old patient, been on treatment with ruxolitinib for 2 years. Hemoglobin's dropped from a baseline of 10 down to 7. Reports worsening fatigue and dyspnea on exertion from the anemia, but overall other symptoms well controlled. What would you recommend for this patient?
So I guess first and foremost, I want to make sure, I want to know how quickly that hemoglobin dropped, just to make sure he doesn't have bleeding or something like that. That it's not, it's, you know, when somebody has myelofibrosis and they have anemia, we just assume it's from the MF, but want to rule out other things first. And he has no other symptoms. So we're really focusing in on the anemia here. So one approach could be we're assuming it looks like he's liking his ruxolitinib. He's had an initial good response to it. We could add on something to try to boost up his hemoglobin. That would be one approach. Another approach could be we could, switch him over to momelotinib.
Yeah, I think you have options here. I think Abe kind of highlighted a few of the different things in development right now. Certainly, I think one of the one of the problems with having options is sometimes we think, oh, well, we should switch everyone with anemia to momelotinib. Mm-hmm. But in practice, try telling that to a patient who's done extremely well on ruxolitinib, right? Mm-hmm. I think we have these patients who you're like, yeah. Oh, well, I think we should switch. And they're like, no, absolutely not. You're not switching me off this. I feel so much better on this. And so, you know, I think that there certainly are other things that we can do. Prithvi, what's your general approach? If you're thinking about adding on and we're not thinking about a clinical trial, what options do you have and what's the data suggest you could do?
Yeah, if you're thinking to add on, then ESA, if the, you know, baseline EPO is low, for me, low is less than 125, danazol or luspatercept. Now, whether I would add on or switch, I mean, depends really on the scenario. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, how much have they benefited? Do they still need, you know, are symptoms and spleen, you know, maybe still an issue? I mean, so those things have to be taken into consideration. But if I switch, certainly to momelotinib, but then add on could certainly work as well.
Abe, have you had experience in adding on luspatercept in clinic? I know you highlighted some of the ongoing clinical trials.
Yeah, so, and again, luspatercept is not yet FDA approved for that indication, but again, it's listed on our NCCN guidelines, and there's a publicly available phase 2 data that shows very good activity, very convincing activity. So really, insurance permitting, I have been. I have been using luspatercept in this particular situation in which ruxolitinib is doing a good job, or the JAK inhibitor of choice is doing a good job controlling the domains of symptoms and spleen, but we're still stuck at the anemia. So we're treating the anemia, not the myelofibrosis. So we're by introducing anemia therapy. So yes, I have. And again, the responses are probably similar to the phase 2 study. Yeah.
Wonderful. All right, Angela, this case may look somewhat familiar to a prior one that we've discussed, but now it's coming after a presentation talking about anemia. So we have a 75-year-old, symptomatic myelofibrosis, receives ruxolitinib 15 milligrams BID, responds well for 2 years with symptom improvement, but over the last few weeks, she's experienced a gradual increase in splenomegaly, hot flashes, fatigue, early satiety. Platelet count's down to 43. Hemoglobin's 8.4. White count 14,000. Not a transplant candidate. What options are you thinking about? What would you recommend for this patient?
So I guess we could go over this sort of the same sort of situation as this does look very similar to the previous one. And could say the same thing. We could the fact that I would go against if we're concerned about the platelet count reducing the ruxolitinib because it looks like she has worsening symptoms. So it's like there's some indication that she needs more JAK inhibition, but yet her platelet count is getting pretty low. I mean, her hemoglobin doesn't look too bad and her white count looks fine. This one, I mean, again, one could, because of the platelet count, and that seems to be a bigger issue than the low hemoglobin, switch over to pacritinib. I would feel uncomfortable increasing the ruxolitinib. Maybe that in maybe other people's mind, that could be that she, you know, she's losing some response and prioritizing the response of spleen's response and symptom response, and just acknowledging that there will probably be a further decrement in her blood counts. I mean, that could be a reasonable alternative.
Yeah, I think you make a great distinction there, which is this is someone who's getting worse, right? Symptomatically getting worse. So lowering the dose of ruxolitinib isn't an option. And one of the benefits of both momelotinib and pacritinib with anemia and thrombocytopenia is that you can fully dose those JAK inhibitors, right? So I think both really are options here of switching to an agent that you can fully dose, and potentially if it's really just the JAK inhibitor dose that's lacking right now, maybe you're able to achieve an improvement in some of those symptoms that seem to be worsening. So I think you do have a few options there, right? And there's clearly overlap with momelotinib and pacritinib, as both Prithvi and Abe showed in their presentations. So Prithvi, what features in your mind differentiate momelotinib for the other JAK inhibitors? And do you believe that this kind of ACVR1 inhibition is really the primary kind of mechanism describing the anemia benefit we see?
I mean that comes from a preclinical study in anemia of chronic disease in a rodent model of that that showed that the anemia benefit stemmed from ACVR1 inhibition, hepcidin downregulation, and then that makes iron more available for erythropoiesis. So certainly I do believe that, and I think that is really what sets this drug apart. It has JAK1 and JAK2. I know we talked a little bit earlier about the pluses and minuses of having JAK1 versus not having JAK1. But again, you know, if you look at the success of ruxolitinib, you know, which is such a good drug for spleen and symptoms, I think, you know, I think most of us are, schooled in the philosophy that JAK1 is important for symptom benefit. So I like that. I think it's a drug that can, address all three sort of cardinal aspects of the disease.
Yeah, I think certainly there's benefits there when talking about kind of being able to take care of everything that's going on, right, as far as comprehensive care. All right, so this is a pretty, I'm going to pose this to each person on the panel, all right? Abe, we'll start with you. So given the recent availability, has the panel switched over to momelotinib as their JAK inhibitor of choice for all patients with higher risk myelofibrosis who present with anemia here, critically defined as a hemoglobin less than 10? So are you doing it for everyone?
So, no.
Okay.
Okay.
All right, good. Angela, what do you think?
Okay. I would say no. I guess if you were to say it would be the first thing on my mind to think about whether this would be a good person for momelotinib, but would clearly need to sort of weigh the other features of the person's disease, mm-hmm. whether a different JAK inhibitor would be more appropriate for them.
That's a bold question.
Yes,
so anyway,
no.
So I think it's a very important thing that we are all faced with, right? New patient, I suppose, right? I assume, newly diagnosed, less than 10 hemoglobin. So we don't know the right answer. So mm-hmm. I discussed that we've got one drug with a proven survival benefit, which is Rux, but it's going to make things difficult for you likely with the hemoglobin. And you know, either we just accept that, or we transfuse, or we give some additive agent for anemia, or we do momelotinib, which is going to be easier to dose and may have a survival benefit, just not shown as clearly. And I really have that discussion and involve the patient. I don't think any of us really knows.
Yeah, I think it's fun to kind of speak in absolutes, right? And say, obviously, we're, you're not doing this for everyone. But the question that I always have is, you know, when we look at Simplify One, mm-hmm. right? And you see momelotinib compared head to head versus ruxolitinib, and there ruxolitinib was better at symptoms, mm-hmm. right? But that was really a largely a non-anemic population. And so then the question is, well, is there a hemoglobin value? Right, or a threshold where that wouldn't have been the case, right? And even in the subgroup analysis, looking at patients with a hemoglobin less than 10, still seems like ruxolitinib has some favorability in terms of symptoms, but I don't really know if that's the case at 9 or 8 or 7 or transfusion dependent, right? Do you guys have a sense for a threshold where you say, no, I'm going to move to momelotinib at that point?
So just to kind of expand on this, again, myelofibrosis is a chronic cancer in which we are allowed to make preferences and then change them, right? So you could start with one therapy, then decide it was not actually optimum. As long as you follow the patient, reassess, reevaluate, there's really no one wrong answer or one right answer in this setting, as long as you actually understand the decision implications and you have follow-up on it. So when we start Rux on these patients, we probably do labs more often than the label, which is every 2 weeks. We probably could consider anemia therapy along with ruxolitinib early on, even up front, preemptive, to not get anemic. So we could consider that. You educate the patient about the first nadir effect, and then maybe if you muscle through 8 weeks, 12 weeks, anemia could bounce back. So there are some tricks we've learned over the years in how to deliver Rux in anemic patients. But then when it gets to transfusion dependence, it gets saturated my threshold. Like if somebody is transfusion dependent, if I made him transfusion dependent, it's even worse. But transfusion dependence is maybe the threshold where I think maybe momelotinib would be a better first choice.
Yeah, this is not politics. So we are allowed to change our minds, and it's not held against us. Yeah. So, you know, I think I agree with you all, right? I don't think that we're using it for all patients with hemoglobin less than 10. I have had this come up, you know, I think more frequently in clinic lately. And, mm-hmm. I think one of the approaches I've had recently is it really depends on why we're treating the patient, right? And so if the patient's coming with a high symptom burden, maybe, you know, and a hemoglobin that's low, oftentimes if we're trying to improve their symptoms, I'll start with ruxolitinib, really regardless if transfusion requirements or not, with the understanding that likely, you know, we're going to have worsening of the hemoglobin. And maybe I'll do combination of ESA or something like that. But one thing that I would like to know is, do their symptoms respond to JAK inhibition? Because if they do, and then they worsen, and I switch to momelotinib at that point in time, then I know, like, at least they have JAK inhibitor responsive symptoms. I think one of the things that comes up in patients where, if you start them on momelotinib is, you know, conceptually, ruxolitinib may be better at symptoms or certain symptoms than momelotinib. But if they don't feel that much better on momelotinib, I always have the question, is it because, you know, they don't have JAK inhibitor responsive symptoms, or is it because, you know, that they're just not responding to momelotinib where they might respond to Rux? And so I've kind of gone back and forth with this, and I've changed my mind a few times on this, and certainly I think other factors of the patient, you know, factor in. How close are they to the center? How good of healthcare follow-up do they have? Like, are you able to see them weekly, or are they 2.5 hours away where you're not really going to tolerate a hemoglobin down? All that kind of factors in when you make these decisions. But I think overall while we certainly do like the option of having momelotinib for patients with anemia, it's not, you know, we're not using it for everyone, right, with a hemoglobin.
I would like to commend you on the question, because honestly, this is probably the most controversial, or at least real-life challenge that we have every day with those patients.
And it's ongoing, right, especially as we have clinical trials with add-on agents that are coming down that we'll highlight as well, right? I don't think that this is necessarily set in stone of what we're going to do moving forward. So I do want to highlight a couple questions before we move to our next presentation from the audience. And there may have a little bit less to do with anemia, but I think they're important questions. And so we got a few that came in like this. So what's your approach to someone who comes in otherwise relatively low risk, relatively normal blood counts, but has an enlarged spleen that's somewhat asymptomatic, right? So let's say the spleen is 21 centimeters. Is there a threshold where you would treat a spleen being enlarged if it's not causing a ton of symptoms? Prithvi, what do you think?
So I don't have a numerical threshold, but I'm increasingly convinced of the benefits of starting Rux early. There's just mounting evidence from many trials, you know, looking at earlier risk patients and what that can get you, which you may not get if you intervene too late. So I absolutely will have that discussion that, you know, in somebody with that 21 centimeter spleen, granted they're feeling okay, not necessarily feeling it much, but they could get a long-term, you know, even VAF reduction occurs better when you start early in the disease. So, I'm more and more convinced about this.
Yeah, I think, and often patients with 21 centimeter spleens are perhaps more symptomatic than maybe they understand too.
Yeah, so that's really the other point is that, you know, patients who've had symptoms over a while, they really just learn to live with them. And if you treat them and they get better, that's when you think, you know what, I wasn't actually feeling well. Yeah. And sometimes a therapeutic trial is what uncovers the symptoms.
Yeah, I think we've all had patients, right, where we started them on Rux and they realize, or any other of the JAK inhibitors, and they say, well, I didn't realize the symptoms I was having prior to going on this, right? I think that, or patients who maybe were started on Rux and come off and realize symptoms that they were having, you know, that had been masked, right, while being on it, and then we restart. So, wonderful discussion. We're now able to move over to our last module of the day with Dr. Fleischman talking about where do we go from here? What are the future directions? How are we going to move the field forward?
Okay, great. Thank you. So what I'm going to be talking about is future directions in the management of myelofibrosis. In our previous talks, we went over in depth the current FDA-approved drugs focusing on JAK inhibitors, but what I'll be talking about is non-approved drugs today, including navitoclax, pelabresib, selinexor, and imetelstat. So in terms of the mechanistic rationale for navitoclax, it's a BCXL inhibitor, and many of the BCL proteins are anti-apoptotic proteins, which many different types of cancer cells utilize to stay alive. And specifically with regards to BCXL, there's preclinical data demonstrating that BCXL is upregulated in myeloproliferative neoplasms, in particular in myelofibrosis. And also in vitro, navitoclax plus ruxolitinib induces apoptosis of MPN patient samples. So that provides a strong preclinical rationale for investigating navitoclax in combination with ruxolitinib in the TRANSFORM-1 study, which was a phase 3 double-blind multicenter study. And then these patients, they were intermediate 2 or high risk JAK-naive myelofibrosis patients with splenomegaly and symptoms, and then were stratified to either the experimental arm of the combo of ruxolitinib plus navitoclax or the control arm of ruxolitinib plus placebo. And this is the case in many MF clinical trials. Primary endpoint was the spleen volume response at week 24, with secondary endpoints being additional spleen volume response endpoints, symptom score reduction, and anemia response, as well as safety. And this is the familiar waterfall plot that we many times see in myelofibrosis clinical trials, with each person being a bar. There was a significantly higher number of patients in the combo arm who achieved a spleen volume response compared to the ruxolitinib-only arm. However, the total symptom score responses were not significantly different between groups, and therefore the TRANSFORM-1 did close early, failing to meet this endpoint. And then also importantly, going over adverse events, thrombocytopenia, anemia, and neutropenia were common, as would be expected. And then moving on to preclinical rationale for BET inhibitor in myelofibrosis. So BET is an important protein for multiple aspects that have relevance to myelofibrosis disease pathology, such as differentiation of myeloid cells from megakaryocytes, also NF-kappa B, which is a pro-inflammatory cytokines, and pelabresib, a BET inhibitor, therefore has multiple theoretic mechanisms of action in myelofibrosis. So MANIFEST-2, a randomized double-blind phase 3 study was performed. Again, JAK inhibitor-naive patients with intermediate 1 or higher myelofibrosis who had splenomegaly and symptoms. Again, randomized to either the combo of pelabresib plus ruxolitinib or placebo plus ruxolitinib. And the primary endpoint, again, as is common in these studies, spleen volume response at week 24 with key secondary endpoints, symptom score reduction, as well as important to look at safety. And this is a nice way to look at the data in a little bit of a different way with a Venn diagram, because our two sort of cornerstones of treatment in myelofibrosis are the spleen and the symptoms. So looking at which percentage of patients achieved both of those. So in the combination arm, pelabresib plus ruxolitinib, 40.2% had both the spleen volume response and the total symptom score response, as compared to 18.5% of the patients in the placebo plus rux arm. And then because, as we learned earlier, that anemia is a very important problem in myelofibrosis and a key unmet need in this disease, investigating hemoglobin of the patients on this study, and a numerically greater proportion of patients achieved a hemoglobin response with the combination of pelabresib plus ruxolitinib versus placebo plus ruxolitinib. And the safety profile of pelabresib plus ruxolitinib combo was consistent with clinical previous clinical trials, and quite similar to the gray bars moving to the right, placebo plus ruxolitinib. And then moving on to yet another agent, selinexor. Selinexor is an XPO1 inhibitor, and exportin-1 is important shuttler of multiple proteins from the nucleus to the cytoplasm, and inhibits transport of many proteins, which have relevance to myelofibrosis disease pathology, both in terms of oncogenes as well as in terms of inflammation. And then the ESSENTIAL trial, which is a investigator-initiated clinical trial coming out of Utah, looking at myelofibrosis patients who were JAK inhibitor experienced, investigating different dosings of selinexor. And on the left is a swimmer's plot, just so you can see details of each patient, what dose they were started on, how long they had been on the study, and what their sort of end result was, and on the right, overall survival. And the Sentry 2 of selinexor, which was a phase 2 study looking at efficacy and safety of selinexor monotherapy in patients with JAK inhibitor naive myelofibrosis and moderate thrombocytopenia. And this is an interesting study design in which patients were started lead-in with single-agent selinexor, but at later time points, either at week 12 or 24, depending on the spleen volume response, are allowed to add on a JAK inhibitor. So that's an interesting study design there. And then the Export MF 034, which is a phase 3 study of selinexor in combination with ruxolitinib in JAK inhibitor naive myelofibrosis patients. Phase 1, a dose escalation, and phase 1A, a dose escalation, and 1B, dose expansion, with primary endpoints really focusing on dosing with maximal tolerated dose and ideal dose in addition to adverse events, with secondary endpoints being the standard ones of spleen volume response, total symptom score, anemia response, and also other things like overall survival. And then here on the left, again, displaying the data as a Venn diagram with the overlap of the patients who had both spleen volume response and total symptom score, 50%, albeit, as you can see, the ends are quite small. And then on the right, bar graphs of different specific symptoms, demonstrating that the point is to demonstrate that there was symptom improvement throughout the different aspects of the symptoms. And then quickly moving on to imetelstat, which is a telomerase inhibitor. Telomerase maintains the ends of the telomeres, which is important for rapidly dividing cells, such as cancer cells, to maintain their telomeres. And so a telomerase inhibitor theoretically should inhibit that, thus causing cell death. And the MF2001 is a phase 2 study of imetelstat in myelofibrosis in intermediate 2 or high risk myelofibrosis patients who had had previous JAK inhibitor dosing. I think the important point of this study is identification of the dose moving forward. We're given two different doses of imetelstat, 9.4 or 4.7 milligrams per kilogram every 3 weeks, and the co-primary endpoints, spleen response and symptom response.
And then key safety data, I think the importance is to look at, compare the 4.7 to 9.4, as expected, with a higher dose, do see more hematologic adverse events, but not necessarily significantly more non-hematologic safety data. And then in terms of key efficacy data, here's where it's intriguing to see the longer overall survival of 28 versus 19.9 months in the 9.4 versus 4.7 dosing arm, as well as differences in spleen response. So then moving forward, 9.4 milligrams per kilogram every 21 days was identified as the optimal dose to investigate moving forward. And then here is the IMPACT MF phase 3 study design, which enrolls intermediate 2 and high-risk patients to either imetelstat or best available therapy. And I think what's important to note here is the very forward-thinking endpoint of overall survival in this clinical trial. So very interested to see the data from this study. And then just quickly as we end, other promising investigational agents, zilgersibib, sorry if I mispronounce this, which we heard from Dr. Jakub about the importance of ACVR1 inhibition as an eventual inhibitor of hepcidin, which theoretically may play a role in the improvement of anemia that we see from momelotinib and pacritinib, and the MDM2 inhibitor, navtemadlin, which as an MDM2 inhibitor will reactivate P53, which could have efficacy in P53 wild-type myeloproliferative neoplasms.
Wonderful, Angela. Thank you so much for kind of giving us a glimpse into the future of where things go. And now we have some time to go over some questions regarding those data. We also have some audience questions. We'll be like kind of a potpourri of different topics that we can address as well. but Prithvi, I'll kind of start off to you because a lot of these questions are talking about selinexor and pelabresib as we kind of are moving into the future. And this is a challenging one for you, but what are we excited about with selinexor, and do you have concerns based on kind of the what occurred with pelabresib and navitoclax in terms of endpoints with the current trials that are ongoing with selinexor?
Yeah, sure. I mean, just to kind of start, the whole point of all of this is the holy grail of disease modification, right? Like, can we do something beyond spleen and symptoms? Can we really meaningfully extend overall survival? Although remember, Rux does do that, but can we really, have an anti-clonal effect beyond an anti-inflammatory effect that Rux very nicely has, and augment survival. So all of these, as you alluded to, Andrew, it was disappointing last year to learn that navitoclax, for one, did not meet the symptom endpoint. Pelabresib also just missed it. And so the concerns that have been raised are, one, does the second drug add toxicity so that it's not reasonable to think that you're going to beat a very good drug like Rux at symptoms? So that's one. I mean, so is the bar very high? And ought we, should we stop expecting that and focus on other endpoints? Like, there was a doubling of the spleen response, like Angela showed, for navitoclax and for pelabresib. So that is definitely, does that concern play into selinexor a little bit? Yeah, I think for any of these combinations, you would worry that if you're pitting it against Rux monotherapy, which is really very good for symptoms, then could you have problems with the endpoint? Also, it's such a subjective endpoint, right? I mean, it's based on questionnaires, and so you always wonder what effect that has.
Yeah, I think that sometimes we want to do better, right? We want to improve on existing therapy, but we do quite well with single agent ruxolitinib in terms of improving symptoms. And so requiring a combination strategy to be better than good is I think a high bar, and not something that we would do in other malignancies, right? Rarely do you look at combination chemotherapies and say, you know, not only do we want a better disease response, but we also want people to have less toxicity, right? That's not really the expectation.
Yeah.
But I think that it really is a challenge in the way that we're currently having to kind of evaluate these agents. So Abe, in terms of combining selinexor with ruxolitinib, I'll frame this another way. Mm-hmm. Are we, with all kind of frontline clinical trials, are we going to get away from JAK inhibitors, or is that really going to be something that's going to be a part of anything we look at going forward?
All right, so that's really many dimensions to this question. So again, JAK-STAT pathway activation seems to be the hallmark of the disease, and not tackling it, it just seems to be not on the short horizon, at least, not to include a JAK inhibitor pathway, or at least after JAK inhibitors fail, that when you consider agents are non-JAK inhibitors. The other dimension to this is that there's a lot of agents with fantastic mechanism of actions that have been tried in myelofibrosis, and the preclinical work and is necessary. The non-human studies, cell line studies, are fantastic. Early phase studies can give signals, but really the phase 3 studies are the actual test in which those drugs are made or broken. So once we actually, hopefully the studies become positive and we get objective data showing efficacy, then the mechanism of action makes a lot of sense. Before that, it's really hard to say that the rationale, but the rationale is in the results from the phase 2 data is very compelling. The objective responses are just very, very impressive results so far.
Yeah, I think that we're not at a point yet where we can kind of ditch JAK inhibitors, right? But certainly we can optimize them and right. Figure out the right ones to use in combination as well.
And I would say we're not looking for a fifth one either.
Yeah.
I think we're good with four.
Yes. I think so. The next question, Angela, kind of talks about and kind of alludes to the challenge we have with selinexor, that we have experience with this agent in other disease states, right? And other trials that have been run, and GI toxicity appears to be one. And this has been an issue for fedratinib. It's been an issue for pacritinib. And now, potentially when we're looking at having to hit a symptom benefit, right, as well, it poses a problem there. So, is there an optimal approach? Do you know what is being done to kind of mitigate this in ongoing trials?
So you have a good point that, I don't really know how to answer this question, to tell you the truth. But from my perspective in a JAK inhibitor naive myelofibrosis patient, to warrant additional toxicities, you've got to really defined what is the value added. And if it's simply value added of spleen and symptom response, for which you can probably expect in a JAK inhibitor naive person that they're going to get a good spleen and symptom response from JAK inhibitor by itself, one needs to have an additional value added for that, an agent that's going to give additional toxicity.
A bang for the buck, if you will.
Yeah.
Right? And I think the encouraging thing is what we've seen with fedratinib, right, in the FREEDOM2 study, which is if you aggressively prophylax for nausea, right, you can make these things much more tolerable in practice. And I think, one of the big concerns, going back when fedratinib was coming out, I think we looked at Jakarta and we saw 2/3 of patients are having nausea, 50, 60% of patients are having, diarrhea, 40-something percent of patients are having vomiting, right? This is not an agent that patients are going to want to take long-term, yes. Right? We're not talking about taking this for 2 cycles and stopping. We're talking about a long-term agent. But I think in practice, that wasn't necessarily the case, right? I think having some experience now with fedratinib, there is some GI toxicity, but if you give patients antiemetic therapy up front and counsel them, it becomes a lot more manageable. And then you also realize that, just kind of my soapbox here is when patients are on a clinical trial for 6 months, if they ever have nausea, like one time for any reason during those 6 months, right, and they report that, it's listed as nausea, right? And so it just because there's high rates of it doesn't mean that it's severe or challenging.
Right.
It also doesn't mean that it's not, right? And so I think there is nuance to interpreting some of this data.
And I would add that, you know, the once a week dosing, this is a really low dose, lower than what people have seen with selinexor in other indications. It's only 60 milligram once a week. And I'm a big believer in the fact that Rux actually attenuates some of the toxicity. We've seen this with naftamadlin, for example. So I think with this strategy they're employing of dual anti-emetics for the first two cycles, I think so far it's working out well.
Yeah, I think getting ahead of the game, right, and acknowledging that this is something and coming up with a strategy is you know, the only way you're going to have success with that. Yeah.
Yeah. So Andrew, and we keep getting asked that if any of this combination gets approved, would you use it or not, right? And that's really in whether it's in any of the agents are still in the run, and they all come with some collateral adverse events. But as hematologists oncologists, we deliver drugs that have side effects, and we will learn how to manage them and deliver them. And I think the answer is consistently yes. If a phase 3 study is successful and meets the endpoints and the regulatory team approves it, I think I'd definitely be an adopter and deliver it to the patients and learn how to support them. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think we certainly want to move the field forward. And I think that we realize right now we're doing a great job, I think, of improving patients' symptoms, but we'd like to do more than that. And that's where some of these combinations may play out. Now, you know, we'll have probably similar discussions if one gets a combination gets approved as, are you going to use it across the board, right?
Yeah.
Like we asked with momelotinib, or is this going to be something that's used in special cases? And I think that, you know, I'm kind of excited to have those conversations at some point. So moving on to imetelstat, I'll take this one, which is, you know, what is it and when should it be used? A combination or is it by itself? I think we're still trying to figure that out, honestly. I mean, I think the phase 2 data where it was used in relapse refractory patients really in two different doses left us with kind of confusing results as far as how to interpret them, which was we didn't see a ton of clinical responses that we're used to, splenomegaly reductions and symptom improvements, though there were some, they were modest. What we did see is the patients that were on the higher dose lived a lot longer than one we expected, and two, that the lower dose lived. So it was almost like a built-in placebo there, where patients lived 30, 32 months, which in the relapse refractory population, that's about three, maybe 2 to 3 times longer than we expected. And so that was the basis for the kind of ongoing phase 3 trial looking at imetelstat versus best available therapy in the relapse refractory population. At the same time, we go back to the fact that should we really be kind of getting rid of JAK inhibition altogether? And that's where there's ongoing kind of early phase studies, phase 1, 1B studies that are looking at the combination of Rux from imetelstat. And I think that rationale makes a ton of sense when you're saying, hey, we have an agent that doesn't give a lot of these typical clinical responses, but maybe disease modifying. Let's combine it with the agent that we don't think is that disease modifying, but gives us the clinical responses. But ultimately, and this will be presented, I think the initial data will be presented at this meeting, where we'll start to get a sense of what we're seeing with that combination. So, and then Prithvi, I'll give you the kind of last word before we move to our potpourri section of questions. So any other promising investigational agents that we didn't mention so far that you wanted to kind of highlight?
Yeah, I think sort of in the same league as these is naftamadlin, which Angela did certainly mention briefly. But that's also in phase 3, and that's MDM2 inhibition with a very unique trial design. I think we've never seen this before in the field, where patients who are, you know, JAK inhibitor naive enter the trial and they stay on Rux for a certain period. I think it's 12, 24 weeks. There are certain assessments made. And if both spleen and symptom endpoints are not met, both, that is when they are considered suboptimal and the naftamadlin or placebo is added. So I think that's a very cool design. It'll require a lot of patience and a lot of time, but very interesting. And certainly this is a drug that in phase 2, we've seen some very interesting results. In fact, 2 oral presentations this ASH meeting on the clinical and the translational aspects from the phase 2, the Borea study, the monotherapy.
Wonderful. Yeah, certainly exciting time. Can't wait for some of these presentations. I think the naftamadlin, certainly an interesting couple of presentations, and then it kind of leads into the ongoing phase 3 study with it as well. So, all right. So now we're going to move to a little bit of a hodgepodge of questions that I'll target to folks that we've got some spicy ones as well. So one of the questions did come in, and it's very appropriate, which is in patients that, In patients with kind of lower risk myelofibrosis, is there any non-pharmacologic approaches that one could take, such as diet, exercise, things like that, that have any outcomes, benefits that have been shown with them? I know, Angela, you've done a lot of work looking at this. What would your kind of recommendations be?
So I guess I could say, you know, obviously yes, and this is an area that I'm very interested in, that, you know, we really emphasize in the, you know, the higher risk patients, they clearly do need some pharmacologic management. However, all myelofibrosis patients can benefit from an improvement in their lifestyles. It's, very healthy diet. And also a lot of times myelofibrosis patients will think that they're, you know, we always claim that myelofibrosis patients many times are underweight, but many times they are overweight, and maybe, you know, focusing on healthy lifestyle, healthy dieting to actually get their weight down to normal so they're able to exercise. But I would say that, yes, this very early myelofibrosis patient population, I think, is a population in whom lifestyle management might be most impactful.
Wonderful. And the other question was, should you advise all myelofibrosis patients to be on these new weight loss agents? I'm just kidding. That wasn't the question. Sorry.
However, a lot of people do ask. I get
That is a common question in clinic, I think, now. So I did not want to throw that in there. So Prithvi, all right. So you've done some work in this and published on this, but what is the optimal treatment for patients with accelerated or blast phase disease with accelerated blast phase MPN? Are you typically using intensive chemotherapy? Is it HMA-based therapy, HMA venetoclax? How do you approach these patients?
Yeah, unfortunately, there really is none that one can call optimal, I guess. But, we tend to do HMA with ruxolitinib, actually. Venetoclax, in our experience and in the experience of several other institutions, really does not add that much. So, and in fact adds a lot of toxicity. So what we tend to do is, unless a transplant is lined up and fairly certain, we do not typically use venetoclax. So we'll use HMA with JAK inhibitor, or we'll do, this may be more of an MD Anderson thing, but we do a cladribine alternating with low-dose cytarabine, which we've had a lot of success with in AML as a whole, with ruxolitinib as well.
Yeah, I think that I'm kind of in the same boat where the data really doesn't support the combination of HMA venetoclax, probably because there's more reliance upon BCL-XL potentially, but at the same time, you know, if we do have transplant lined up, oftentimes we will add venetoclax to try to get a quicker response to move to transplant, because we did see higher response rates in a lot of those studies.
Yeah.
Overall survival benefit because the toxicity outweighed it. So one way to get past that. Certainly, intensive chemotherapy I have used for patients if they don't have P53 mutations driving their progression specifically, and we have a transplant lined up as well. Things like, you know, cladribine-based regimens or high-dose cytarabine-based regimens as well. For some of those patients, in fit patients who I think can tolerate it. But I will say that the efficacy of some of the IDH inhibitors in this place is something that really it's I'm almost hoping for the presence of an IDH mutation. Yep. In patients that do progress to blast phase. Those do occur quite commonly, and I think that's a really great option. And there's not a ton of data, but the data that is out there looks quite good for those agents. Okay, so moving on to another question here. So is there a role for azacitidine, right, in ABALT, in patients who may present with a more kind of myelodepletive phenotype, maybe more of an MDS-like phenotype? Is there a place for azacitidine?
Yeah, so again, as we manage the spectrum of myeloid cancers, you know, we're starting to see similarities, you know, between high-risk MDS versus myelofibrosis that's myelodepletive. Actually, the old terminology was myelodysplastic myelofibrosis. That was the terminology at one point. So I think there is, and also with rising blasts, because really, unfortunately, most myelofibrosis patients either succumb to disease progression or to leukemia transformation. So again, whichever path the patient is on, HMA therapy can have a role, as patients are moving into the accelerated and blast phase direction.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think it's important to remember these diseases exist on a spectrum. And sometimes as the blasts increase, maybe the you can look at the variant allele fraction sometimes and see that it's a low-level JAK2, maybe a lot of other MDS-like mutations. And there may be a role for treating things more like MDS if that's really how they're acting. Mm-hmm. So this was Angela. So what would, I just like the phrasing of this question.
Okay,
Angela question.
What would motivate choosing momelotinib over ruxolitinib in an anemic patient, since momelotinib was approved based on a phase 3 study with a nonsensical comparator? So I'll take this for a second. So I think there is a lot of comments on choosing danazol, right, as the comparator arm in the MOMENTUM study. And I think that while it seems overall, you know, somewhat atypical, I think it makes a lot of sense, actually, in why it was chosen. And you know, not to belabor the point, but you saw from SIMPLIFY 1, SIMPLIFY 2 that momelotinib is effective in the second line setting, improves symptoms in the second line setting with SIMPLIFY 2, is better in an anemic population, and probably better, you know, in isolating kind of the post-RUX setting. And so MOMENTUM was designed as being a study where the primary endpoint was symptoms, which is subjective. And so you have to have a blinded study when you're looking at symptoms as the primary endpoint. To have a blinded study, you need a placebo, right? So you need them to take something. And in the post-RUX setting, there's no real standard of care. But in anemic patients, we do use danazol there.
Yeah.
It's a pill. It can be blinded against that. And so there's no good options. But I think it's the best of the options that were had there that led to that. Ultimately, you know, you could argue whether or not it makes a ton of sense, but there was no perfect comparator arm there.
The one thing I would add is that it actually did have activity with anemia. So
right.
It actually did increase anemia. I think at the end of that study, both momelotinib and danazol had uptake. You know, like I think the use of danazol increased after that study.
Someone say it's the largest, most compelling evidence for danazol that's out there. So with that, we have reached our time. So I want to thank everyone. I want to thank our panelists here for a wonderful, lively discussion. And thank you all for attending.